Hi, everyone. Shavua Tov. It's a new week. You're listening to Eve Harrow on Rejuvenation for the Land of Israel Network. It's January 22nd, 2017, the 24th day of Tevet, 5777. As I lit candles Friday night to close last week and move into the holiness of Shabbat, into our 25 hours, that's kind of like a taste of the world to come, Me'en Olam Haba. So as usual, as I lit candles, which is a really beautiful moment for many Jewish women, praying for my family, praying straight from my heart, for my family, for the people I love, for the safety of our soldiers, for my country. And since it was just before the time of the inauguration of the 45th president of the United States, Donald Trump, so I added a special prayer that Hashem, in his infinite wisdom, give the new president, the vice president, and the whole administration the purpose and direction that it will need. America has enemies within and without, something that we know of all too well in Israel. And they will need all the wisdom and all the strength that they can get. So from really the depth of my heart, may God bless America and help their new leaders to fulfill its promise to make America great again and prove its detractors wrong. I hope that whether someone supported him or not, everyone hopes for his success, because his success is, I would hope, America's success. So my show today, moving on to other matters, my show today is with Jean-Pierre Weil, who's an artist and more recently an author and an illustrator. It was recorded a few days ago at his home in Tekoa, which is a Jewish village at the eastern side of Gush Etzion in the Judean hills, across the valley from Herodian, the palace fortress and burial place of King Herod. So Tekoa, the modern village, is named for the prophet Amos, who lived nearby in a village now called Tikwa. It's an Arab village. It's been 2,700 years, and a lot of conquerors have come in and taken over many places that were once Jewish. But now there's a new Jewish town next door called Tekoa, and that is where I went to see him. But anyhow, yeah, so we're not exactly back in the original Tekoa, but we are back, and we've got no intention of going anywhere. So if you like philosophical thinking, you're in for a real treat today. And I'm once again so grateful to be able to share with you one of my people who shares this land with me by choice. I am sitting now with Jean-Pierre Weil, author, illustrator, and artist. I met him a few weeks ago when I came out to Gush Etzion. We're in Tekoa now in the beautiful home that he shares with his wife, Rachel Rottenberg. I came on an artist's boycott day. I wanted to show people the beauty and the richness and the talent of people living out here in Judea and Samaria. I've done this a couple of times. And so I found myself in the studio of Jean-Pierre, beautiful 3D paintings, 3D glass paintings, and people were just enthralled. But as it turns out, he's not just a one-dimensional man, and he's also written a book. So with all of these things taken together, I said, that's it. This has to be shared with the world. So first of all, thank you so much for taking the time away from all your art to sit with me today.
Hi, Eve, everybody. It's wonderful to be speaking with you, Eve, and thank you for inviting me to your show.
So how about sharing your story? You didn't just end up here in, like, you know, the Judean desert. How'd you get here? What's yours and Rachel's story?
We moved here about 2 years ago. Rachel and I are both working artists who've been living in Baltimore and then before that in New York. Three of our five children live in the Gush area, so we moved to be near them, to be near our grandchildren, and to keep working as we do. We put studios in our home. We spent our lives really having our studios attached to our homes wherever we lived. And so we have this wonderful blessing in which we can live out here in Tekoa and keep working. Rachel is a sculptor for 30, 40 years. We met in art school, in the School of Visual Arts in Manhattan in 1980. So that takes you way back to where we met, and here we are, continuing to work. I have published a book called The Well of Being, a children's book for adults. It's a project I'm very proud of. It's a illustrated picture book narrative told with the simplicity of like a child's book. And it's a narrative. It's a philosophical narrative about well-being. using illustration, imagery, to convey the ideas. I'm very pleased to talk about that, since that's really what's uppermost in my creative life right now.
So let me ask you about the title for a second, because normally when we talk, we say well-being, right? And here you've done somewhat of a play on words, right? The well of being. So where does that come from?
That's exactly right. It's a pun, and I use puns throughout the book. Either they're visual puns or word puns. But well-being, one can say, has a depth, and that's what the pun refers to. It's the depth of living our lives deeply in the realities of the reality of our own making, which we can live within in a relation that I call well-being.
I'm fascinated by the idea of wells. My listeners won't be surprised. It comes up every once in a while. First of all, in the Bible, there are an enormous number of stories where people meet each other by a well. And a well in the ancient world symbolized being able to live. If you had, especially here in this part of the world where we don't have rain 6 months out of the year, if you're not able to draw water out of somewhere, you can't drink. Obviously, you can't eat. And the well also symbolized the way the community ran, how you shared the water, who had access to the well. It was much more symbolic than just being this quaint little hole in the ground where you dipped a bucket and you got your water. And I think that the Bible really gives us so much texture and depth to our lives that we miss because our lives now in the 21st century do not connect to the way they did there. So that's one of the things that really attracted me, first of all, is the well of being, because being, again, well-being, most people would say, is like living a good life, which for, I guess, a lot of people means having a lot of things. But the word being itself, how do you express that? What for you is being? So not fair. Also, you know what's not fair also is that we're speaking in English. And my listeners know this, that Hebrew is such a rich language. Like even God's name, what people will say, Jehovah, right? Or how we spell in Hebrew, Yod, Hey, Vav, Hey, really means just is. You know, it's like that tense of was, is, and the future. That's what that word means. Being, the being, in a way that you really cannot describe. So English is quite limiting, I find, anyhow, when you talk about anything spiritual whatsoever. So how would you describe the difference between well-being and being?
I mean, when you ask me a question like that, it's a deeply philosophical, you know, inquiry that I can't answer in the kinds of abstractions that I think would make sense in this interview. I wrote a book that is decidedly simple, using words and especially imagery to convey ideas that I think are what actually makes this book unique. If there's anything unique about this book, if there's anything special about it, it's in telling a story, a simple, a profound narrative story that's not my own story, but is told frequently in the perennial philosophies of the world, but it's told in this idiom of a child's picture book.
So that's actually what I think is the strength of this book. And, you know, I'm going to apologize to my listeners because we're very limited here. This is radio. All you're hearing, you're getting sounds. You're not getting the visual, which is why you are going to have to go into the website, which we're going to talk about later, and actually, you know, try and get the book yourselves. But Daniel Coleman, who's the author of the international bestseller, Emotional Intelligence, wrote as some kind of review on this book, Wells' creative genius shines as writer, artist, and thinker, which is why I'm not letting you off the hook when it comes to this philosophical idea. Everyone should read this book. It's a mind changer. But more than reading this book, I think people have to see the book, because a lot of philosophical books don't come with illustrations. We all were in college, or many of us are in college, I learned every philosopher, probably quite a few, not every, but quite a few. But their books didn't come with pictures. And sometimes the apparent simplicity of the picture is much more powerful in relaying the idea than the words are, because really most of us are, thankfully, those of us who can see, and I would hope that most of us do have that ability to see, then the picture imprints it in our brain and transforms the idea in a way that just simply reading the words wouldn't be able to do. So if you can give an example maybe in the book here of an idea you know, an idea on a page or a sentence that you wrote, and then try and describe the picture that came of it, and maybe this isn't fair, what came first? Did you first draw the picture? Did you first illustrate the thought and then write down the thought? Or did you write down the thought and then say, okay, now I've got to get the picture to go with it?
This book unfolded without a clear structure. I thought it would begin as a illustrated commentary on a famous poem called The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock by an American poet, T.S. Eliot. When I was about a third of the way through the book, I realized that this was going to be a telling of a certain very simple philosophy about how to relate to the world and how we often lose ourselves as we grow up in notions and stories that we have about ourselves that constrict us and also allow us to see the world in our particular way. So I begin this book with a very simple relating of. Let me see if I can just begin the reading of it.
Great.
And see how it goes. In the beginning, there was nothing. I have a picture. Should I describe the picture? It's just a simple O that accompanies that text. In the beginning, there was nothing, only oneness. And then the text for that is, again, now it's a pun. It's a visual pun, a verbal pun as well, in which I have the word alone and all one. Alone has within it the word one. So this is a certain notion of an indescribable primordial
being. I mean, are you to some degree referring to God here or not?
Yes, I am referring to what we call God, but I skirt around that word as best I can, and I actually use a simple circle, an O, to describe what we refer to as God.
Were you always someone who felt God in your life? Because I'm not an artistic person, I look at artists and I think that they got a gift. You're living here in Toccoa. You didn't just end up here because you took a wrong turn. You and your wife made a decision to come here and to continue and perhaps even deepen your artistic output, if you will, because you're both very prolific at what you do. And here you have a book now that you've put out, the first book that you've put out. How do you see your life's journey in terms of a person of faith? And has living here in Israel, has that changed it in any way, made it more difficult or, you know, made it easier or just brought out something that you didn't have before? Because most of your life you spent outside of Israel, you said you spent in the United States. So what has something changed for you here?
Do I have a relationship? Have I always thought I had a relationship with God? What is meant by God? Hashem is so incomprehensible. To say, have I had him in my life? It's like Hashem is in everybody's life. If we don't believe in God, it's simply whatever idea I have of God that I don't believe in. It seems to me that belief or atheism is, they're almost meaningless terms to me. The thing I believe in, I know, is not comprehensible. So what I believe in is beyond certainly any language, any definition. It's such a deeply emotional, deeply intimate question. To answer the question, you have to just weep. And why am I here? I feel at home. The beauty here, Eve, you can see the beauty through this window. It's one of the most extraordinary sights there are. I go out into the canyon behind me in Toccoa, and it's a deeply magical place. I have my family here. I have the people I love most here. I've been married for 31 years. We have 8 grandchildren who are here in the Gush area who have all been born here. How do I describe what that bracha is? It's simply extraordinary. And here, Rachel and I are working in this beautiful environment, working at our peak, I think, in our professional artistic lives. I go outside. I walk down the streets here in beautiful little Toccoa. And it's such a beautiful town. The people here, the children are just bursting with life. This is really a beautiful place. That said, I look out the window and I see the politics. Oh, there's also that. All of that. The politics. the division that I hope I can help heal just simply through being a creative person with my wife, with my family around me. And somehow, in some indirect way, I think they're connected. When I say they, I mean living a creative life, an artistic life, as fully as I can, and just being in this, on this beautiful plot of land, in this divided space that I see through my window, divided in this, you know, the politics out there. It's this funny thing. It's like there's this interior life of artistic, creative energy process, and then there's this world out there that is so full of strife. Yeah, I mean, that's a mystery, right? That's part of what living here is about for me. I've been here about 2 years. I think that's a pretty apt description of what life, how to answer that question, you know, what's life being like here, coming here, being here.
I would say that God is in the beauty and the art and the creativity of the people that he created and put on this world. And one of the most painful things I know for me, and based on what you just said, perhaps for you too, is how that very essence of being, the ultimate being, is so often used to create the exact opposite of what he would have wanted, which is the strife and the chaos and the wars and all the terrible things. So it's like the Big Bang, or how you start off your book, right? Creation is total chaos, muhuma, right? Just, and things were supposed to settle down into some kind of order afterwards. And are the people taking it back to the chaos where it came from? I don't know.
Yeah, I think you're referring to Klipot, I guess, the shattering of the vessels. I'm approaching it from a different angle, this book, which is that there is this evolutionary emergence in which we move from very simple, elemental, if you want, particles to ever more complex wholeness, and that this world is exactly that. It's this emergent complexity that is continually striving towards higher unity in every way. Whether, I mean, here in politics, that's the case, I think. We have division between peoples, and then we have also this underlying effort toward connectedness. That's how I see the trajectory from creation to now. And that's certainly the telling in the book.
Well, part of the more mystical branches of Judaism are that there was a shattering of light when everything was created, and we're the ones who can put it back together. Every good thing that we do, every kindness that someone bestows, every beautiful piece of art that somebody makes, every kind of goodness is working towards somehow healing the world. I know that as an individual, and I look around sometimes and I think, what can I possibly do? I mean, I have no power. There's nothing that I can do to make this world a better place, except to find people like yourself who exist here. There are so many wonderful people in this country that nobody knows about. People just every day getting up, not thinking about the politics and everything else and the chaos, thinking about how to make something, how to go to sleep at night, having done something that made the world more beautiful or better. Does that drive you when you get up in the morning and you see how your day is going to roll out?
Yeah, people are so extraordinary. Everybody here. There's so many interesting people here in Tocoa and beyond in this whole country. There's a kind of a richness I find here that I don't see in Baltimore quite so much. The variety of orientations is amazing here. This community, at any rate, I'm speaking of Tocoa, is in one which there are extremely varied views about virtually everything, and people simply allow that to be side by side. It's funny, there's kind of almost like a deep acceptance here, though often we portray Israel as if it's so divisive, and while that's true, I do see that people are so varied and right up against each other in terms of views within families, within couples here. I mean, this community itself has there are a lot of what you call mixed couples here. One couple is religious, the other one is not religious. There are people across the political spectrum here. They all seem to be in friendship with one another. And that's what I mean by this acceptance.
A lot of the communities, especially in Judea and Samaria, maybe because we're in some kind of like concentrated. Everyone's always looking at us. But I think you make a beautiful point that having differences of opinion does not have to be divisive. It could be this tremendous mosaic, this tremendous coat of many colors, if you will. They can exist side by side, respect each other, love each other, fight fiercely and think the other person is totally wrong, yet still but be here all together. Some of the issues that I see that bother me tremendously with other people don't have respect for other people's opinions. And it's like, if you're right, you know, if I'm right, then you're completely wrong and you have no place here. And that's not what the panoply, I think, of mankind is supposed to be. How boring would it be if we were all the same? And what you have here really is so much of that variation. So what else would you like to say, you know, about the book, about your work?
I mean, the story of this book is amazing. It's been published by Macmillan. It's being published in the United States and Britain. It's being translated into German, into Chinese, into Japanese, into Korean, you know, Portuguese. It's very cool, the story, and it's my first book, and it's a very exciting, you know, narrative. I self-published this book back in 2011. I marketed myself, and I sold it very well. And then one day, it got picked up by a blog post, actually, called brainpickings.org, which reaches about 5 million people in the literary world. And overnight, I was fielding phone calls from different publishers around the world. And I was, you know, literally, I mean, really mobbed. And I negotiated over the phone with Macmillan. And within hours, I had received a $100,000 contract with promises of publishing this in multiple languages. And it just, you know, it blew me away. It was very funny.
You were here in Israel then when this happened?
No, it was just, this was 2 years ago. I was still in Baltimore, just before I came to Israel. It was 2 days before we were leaving with our Lyft to come here. It was very exciting. It was hilarious. It was so unexpected. You imagine these stories of some Hollywood producer finding some singer on a roadside bar and stopping by and just suddenly making her a starlet. And it sort of came a little bit like that. It was just a very lucky, fortuitous thing. Here I am. I'm actually working on a second book. It's called The Well of Becoming. It's a sequel to The Well of Being, and it's formatted in the same way. Again, it's a story, the nature of freedom.
It's interesting that you put the two together, because one would think of the Garden of Eden as being a forced expulsion. And the exodus of Egypt, at least the way it's portrayed in the Bible, is like we're getting out, you know, we're leaving slavery and we're going towards freedom. But really you're connecting the two, because the people are on their own in both those situations. I suppose the Garden of Eden is a lack of freedom because all of your needs are being taken care of, even though it's symbolic with a wonderful place because all your needs are being taken care of. And slavery, to some degree, all your needs are also being taken care of. You're working very hard, but you don't have to make any decisions or worry about anything. And the common thread in both those stories is, I guess, growing up to some degree and having to now take responsibility for the direction of your own life. Is that what freedom is, the freedom to make choices or the freedom from choices?
Yeah, in the way I tell the story in the book, it's the freedom to make choices. But it's not simply the freedom to make choices, it's the freedom to emerge into choice. The leaving of the Garden of Eden is preceded with two things. This is what I'll tell in the sequel book. First, God asks Adam to name the animals. So it's preceded by first the capacity for language, to identify things through language, because that's what language is. Language, words, confer, if you want, the nobility of existence onto the thing named. And secondly, Adam, then after having been given the power of language, as told in Genesis, he eats from the Eitz Hadas, from the tree of good and evil. So the second thing is the capacity to distinguish relative value between those things named. I'll say that again. If you can distinguish the value between two things, then you have now the ability to choose. that's freedom in a certain way. You could define freedom as the capacity to choose. The more I can choose, the more I'm free. And in that sense, I could say that human beings are unique in this freedom, in that we are the only ones with language, that is, with language that we create ourselves. And so that we, again, language is something that we distinguish things from other things in the world, and then we can then choose between those things using relative value. That's the Eitz HaDaas, that's the tree of knowledge, the distinction between good and evil. I'm emphasizing, if you want here, distinction, good, there's evil, there's good, there's not so good, there's even less good, there's bad. And now I choose between them and I am free. And that's why you could think of it as why we leave the Garden of Eden, which is a place where there is no choosing. And we leave and come into a world of this freedom to choose, into a world of history, of storytelling, of narrative. Nature, if you want, doesn't have a narrative, or rather, I would say, living in the state of nature, of an animal state, they don't tell stories about themselves. They simply rest in moment-to-moment consciousness. People are the ones that tell stories about themselves because we make distinctions between things. We make choices. The more we learn to distinguish, the more we can choose. And we become more of a self in our choosing. And I think that that's what Hashem wishes for us, that we choose and that we become independent selves so that we can be in relationship with what we call Hashem. But we can't be in relationship with God unless we are a separate self. And we can't be a separate self unless we can have the capacity to choose. And we don't have the capacity to choose if we can't distinguish between things. If we don't have a language to help put an object of awareness in front of me and decide how to be in relationship to that. That's such a philosophical way of saying something that's not at all philosophical. It's how we live consciously. I mean, there's a long discussion about one could have about the relationship between language and consciousness. They seem inseparable from each other. The Torah is all about that. The story of Genesis is all about that, all about the emergence of language, about words themselves. God creates the world with words, so we create ourselves with words. And that's all in my book.
And it seems to me that that's why this is the passion of your life right now, as opposed to the painting that you did in your earlier years, now the words.
Yeah, the words with imagery. What I'm passionate about is relating the convergence of words and imagery with each other and how they inform each other and how they are so utterly different from each other. Words and imagery, there are two forms of creativity that, when working together, create this wonderful room to explore that has opened up for me with the making of this book. If there's something unique about this book, I think it's that. It's this creative project using words and imagery together. I mean, in fact, the book really grew that way, using them both together. And that's how the second book is also emerging there. I paint and I write in tandem with one another. Incredibly mysterious process for me, because I'm working the book out, polishing the stone as I go along, and I don't know where it will end. It's like writing a novel with no outline whatsoever, which I think many novelists do, and maybe the best of novelists do that, I don't know. But what you'll often hear of writers speaking of how the characters emerge to tell the author where the novel may be going, that's not rare at all. And it may be one of the most creative ways of working, in which things unfold as one goes along. I don't know if a philosopher would write a work that way. There's an overall understanding where there are details, then fill it out. I kind of work it as if I'm discovering where it goes as I write it. And what's curious is that this narrative is a philosophical one. It's as if I'm reasoning myself along as I write the book. And this book is a multi-year project. it doesn't come out in a couple of months. It's a labor of love, too.
I can't help but think about the debate that people have over like how God created the world. Did he just kind of get us going and we wrote the book? He's put up his creations and then we went where we went. Is he been involved every step of the way and we're where we were supposed to go? It sounds like your creative process is like that, it's coming from as it unrolls, as it unfolds. Mm. Then you see where you're going. And also I'm sitting here feeling sad that when we're children, we are taught we have picture books, we have words, mm-hmm. and we have pictures. And it's so obvious that as we're learning, the two go hand in hand. Yet somehow when we get older, the illustrations drop off, the pictures drop off, and we all have these big books with just a lot of type in them. And what your book is a book very much for adults, but with illustrations. And that's really the way of getting the point and the feeling across. You say you live here in Israel and you don't have the language, meaning that you don't have Hebrew, but you have a deeper language. That's what I'm seeing here. You have a language that, as important as words are, there's something beyond that as well, where you just, sometimes you just know. You know, like when you're with someone and you love them, you just know there's a language between people. And I think that that's something that you've captured here that maybe most of us, again, as adults, don't have in our lives anymore. And this was just, every time I look at this, I see something new in here and I feel something new. And it even depends on what mood I'm in when I open the book. Is that
like a Rorschach experience in which you come to the book and read into the book much of what's going on internally?
Because words define, but then they also limit by their very definition.
That's true. That's true. Words do. I mean, you asked a lot of questions there about about God and transcendence and immanence and what I think about, are we creating our own stories or is God leading the way? Or these are perennial questions. They're not answered like that. We're constantly in relationship with God, whatever that means. There's no belief or, as I spoke earlier, belief or disbelief. It's really, utterly meaningless, except as coffee shop talk. It doesn't mean a thing. To be in existence isn't to be relationship with existence. I find difficult to talk about. It's as if like you have a life. You don't have a life. You know, you are a life. You know, it's not a commodity that you manipulate. What is this you that's manipulating your life? You is life. I mean, this is what my book is about. Come into relationship with what is. And what is, to put it simply, it's whoever you are with, whatever you're with, whether it's another person or nature or your own feelings, or come into relationship. That's where God is. God is wherever you are experiencing anything. And in that way, is it imminent? Is it transcendent? Is he running things? Are you running things? I mean, that's all, you know, that's theology. And then, you know, you have all the theological questions come up, and they're very enjoyable and completely unanswerable. I mean, for me, they're quite irrelevant. And conversations that depict God in a way that is theological, it's not really meaningful. It's not being in a relationship with God. That's talking about God. That's not prayer. That's not tefillah. Tefillah is experiential. It's not intellectual. I'm not saying anything that's not been said a million times in different ways. I mean, in certain ways, we've touched upon it in our conversation.
Well, maybe it gets back to what you said about freedom, that this is where the Jewish people, when we say we want to be free in our own land, it's about free to make the choices, which is that you can't really be able to be alive if you can't make those choices. And every single day here, as you said, it's between good and evil. And we see some of the starkest examples of both every single day. You can't run from it here. You can't run from God here, because the kinds of people that God created are all here. And the experiences that people are doing are all here in this very small, very, very small area. It's just all in your face all the time. And I think that with that freedom, of course, comes the responsibility and the dark side and the sadness, because
the freedom is, but freedom is always connected with being responsible. We're being forced here through the political situation that's always right in front of our face to live responsibly, to live responsively, responsibly. They go together, to be responsive, to live with care for the situation that's before us all the time. Every interaction matters. It really matters. How do you come to grips with that? Only through becoming responsive to, I think, what's happening in front of each one of us, in front of me, as I live my day, bringing, if you want, redemption to the land, fixing the land, finding our way from the mess that we're in, more connectedness.
Whatever the essence of God is at every breath that we take.
Well said.
Okay, thank you so much, Jean-Pierre, for a very thought-provoking. And the website is thewelofbeing.co by Jean-Pierre Weil. Again, I apologize to all of you. I almost wasn't going to do this interview because of the difficulty in being able to express over this very limited medium of my voice and my and Jean-Pierre's voice the greatness of the book. So get it, look at it, see for yourselves, and let me know. Once again, so grateful to be able to share with you one of my people who shares this land with me by choice. So thank you, everyone, Ben and Tabitha, and all my listeners. As usual, I love your feedback. Eve@thelandofisrael.com. From the Judean Hills, this has been Eve Harrow, always looking to get and give inspiration and rejuvenation. Goodbye for now.
The best place to stay in Jerusalem is at Windows of Jerusalem Vacation Apartments. Check out their website, www.windowsofjerusalem.com. They've got beautiful 1, 2, 3, 4-bedroom apartments in the best location in the city center with the most beautiful, breathtaking views. And I mean breathtaking. I've stayed there a number of times myself. And I'm telling you, there are few places anywhere in the city where you can take it all in to this degree. The view, the location, the great apartments, plus the wonderful staff will truly make you feel at home in Jerusalem. Book your stay now at windowsofjerusalem.com.
Hello, my name is Tommy Waller. I'm the founder and president of HaYovel. More than 12 years ago, I made my first trip to the land of Israel. What I saw and heard changed my life forever. I stood with Nir Levi, an Orthodox Jewish man in his vineyard in Samaria, on the mountain of blessing. There he opened his Bible and read the prophecy of Jeremiah that said, "You shall yet plant vineyards on the mountains of Samaria." We have the opportunity to join Israel as it celebrates the 50th year of the liberation of Jerusalem, Judea, and Samaria. Come join us as we witness the unveiling of prophecy in the Jubilee year. Come be a part of the biblical narrative. Go to HaYovel.com. That's HaYovel.com to find out more. And I hope to see you there.